This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 9th, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up in Washington, Congress debates $500 billion in military spending as lawmakers press for cuts to food assistance to the poor and other social services. Protesters gather in Charlotte, North Carolina for the Bank of America shareholder meeting, bringing attention to the bank's mortgage practices and its support for the coal industry. And Oakland police are under scrutiny for their treatment of Occupy protesters. We'll look at the latest federal monitoring reports and the history of misconduct within the force. Those stories and more coming up after these headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. President Obama announced his support for marriage equality today. In an interview with ABC this afternoon, he acknowledged that he had been evolving on the issue.
As I talk to friends and family and neighbors, when I think about members of my own staff who are in incredibly committed monogamous relationships, same-sex relationships, who are raising kids together, when I think about those soldiers or airmen or Marines or sailors who are out there fighting on my behalf and yet feel constrained, even now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone, because they're not able to commit themselves in a marriage. At a certain point, I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
This announcement comes as gay rights advocates today launched a series of protests against Amendment 1 in North Carolina, which passed with about 61% of the vote in elections yesterday. The We Do campaign has organized 40 LGBT couples that over the next week will visit government offices and attempt to get married. When Amendment 1 goes into effect, marriage will be defined as being between one man and one woman, and the state will no longer be allowed to recognize any other domestic legal unions. In other gay rights news, after gaining momentum in the Colorado legislature, a civil unions bill appears to be dead. FSRN's Jim Pullen has the story.
During a Tuesday morning rally at the Capitol, hopes were running high that civil unions would finally become a reality in Colorado. Those hopes were bolstered when, in the late afternoon, Representative Sherry Giroux broke ranks with her Republican colleagues to help the bill clear the final committee. The civil unions legislation then went to the House for a reading required before midnight. But as the sun fell, so did hope as Republicans filibustered. Democrats tried to counter, but near midnight, the House Speaker announced that the legislation would not be heard. 30 other bills fell as a result. Now U.S. Representative Jared Polis and the state's log cabin Republicans are pressuring Governor John Hickenlooper, who supports civil unions, to call a special session. Jim Pullen, FSRN, Boulder.
Voters in Wisconsin have picked their challenger for next month's recall election. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will again face Governor Scott Walker, sparking a rematch from 2010. FSRN's Molly Stentz has more from Madison.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett handily defeated his three Democratic rivals and a protest candidate, winning 58% of the vote in Tuesday's primary. Barrett lost to Scott Walker in the 2010 election by a slim margin, one his supporters hope can be bridged with higher voter turnout this year. The recall election has been fueled by public outrage over the governor's attacks on public unions and his cuts to the state health care system and public education. But in Barrett's victory speech Tuesday night, he attacked Walker's record on jobs.
Scott Walker, instead of staying home in Wisconsin and focusing on creating jobs here, has decided that he is going to be a rock star to the far right in this nation.
Meanwhile, Malin Mitchell, president of the state firefighters union and a leader of last year's Capitol protests, picked up the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor. Also, all four Democrats seeking to replace Republican state senators easily survived challenges by protest candidates placed on the ballot by Republicans. The recall election will be June 5th. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
In Albany, California today, police moved to seal off access to a plot of land being used as a community farm. For the past 2 weeks, Occupy the Farm has been planting crops on 2 acres owned by the University of California. FSRN's George Lavender reports.
Early this morning, university police entered the site and warned occupiers that they face arrest if they remain. Several activists said police threatened to use, quote, chemical weapons. Occupation of the Gill Tract followed a 15-year struggle to have the land used for community agriculture. The farmers want the university to stop selling off the property for development. Leslie Haddock is a UC Berkeley student.
We've been cultivating the land for the last 2 weeks. I think everybody feels invested in what happens to this place. And as long as the police are here, we're not going to rest well.
This morning, police blocked entrances and stopped all vehicles from entering the farm. Since the start of the occupation, the university has cut off water to the site. Occupiers say that closing the entrances means they will struggle to keep the crops irrigated. George Lavender, FSRN, Albany, California.
Anti-nuclear activists in India are intensifying a protest against a nuclear power plant under construction in the southern part of the country. FSRN's Shuri Niazi has the details.
The People's Movement Against Nuclear Energy has been protesting construction of the 2,000-megawatt nuclear power plant at Kudankulam for several years. The group based in the southern Tamil Nadu state has intensified its protest, saying Tuesday it collected tens of thousands of signatures opposing the project. Currently, about 340 people are on hunger strike in the village of Idanthikarai. Organizers say more than 20,000 people from the surrounding area have surrendered their voter identity cards because they don't want to vote for government officials who don't respect the hunger strikers' lives and people's interests. One organizer, M. Pushparian, told dynuke.org that police are moving it with plans to arrest protest leaders. He said he fears violence could follow. Shuri Niazi, FSRN, India.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington, lawmakers moved forward with debate on $500 billion of military spending today. The Armed Services Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives took up the Pentagon's 2013 budget, which includes the largest ever military aid package for Israel, including an additional $1 billion for missile shields. The rise in military spending comes as the House considers several major cuts to food assistance for the poor and other social services. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details on Capitol Hill.
The House version of the National Defense Authorization Act asks for over $3 billion more than the president's request, clocking in at nearly $520 billion. But when the Armed Services Committee took up the bill Tuesday, Washington Democrat Adam Smith praised its sensitivity to the nation's current economic crisis.
We're going to have to make some tough choices in the next couple of years to deal with the budget realities. I'm confident this committee is up to that task. If we plan, if we prepare, if we realistically look at what our budget numbers are going to be, I'm absolutely confident that a $550 billion plus defense budget can protect this country.
A new report from the Project on Government Oversight has identified many areas of waste in the budget, including several outdated and duplicated weapon systems. Researcher Ben Freeman contributed to the report.
It's basically national security pork is what they're doing. The problem is taxpayers everywhere have to pay for it, even though taxpayers everywhere don't really benefit from it. If you're not in an area that has a lot of national security jobs, well, then you're just paying money out of your taxes into the stuff that we as a nation may not necessarily need.
The Project on Government Oversight also estimates that the Pentagon could save nearly $375 billion by reducing its over-reliance on private contractors, which eat up more military dollars than all the troops combined.
A lot of these contractors are doing jobs that the DoD itself says should be done by government workers, should not be farmed out to anyone.
The budget also gives Israel the biggest military aid package to date, including nearly an additional $1 billion for a shield program called David's Sling, referencing the weapon used to defeat the giant Goliath in the Bible. The anti-rocket and missile technology was co-developed by private defense contractors in Israel and the United States. Israel's other missile defense programs, Iron Dome and Arrow, will also receive some of the funding. It's the highest ever appropriation in a single year for the program, and comes on top of more than $3 billion in military aid the U.S. gives annually to Israel. The House also took up the United States-Israel Enhanced Security Cooperation Act on Tuesday, which promises many forms of support for Israel, including loan guarantees, weapons, military training, and information sharing. The bill also requires the U.S. to veto any U.N. resolutions it sees as anti-Israel. Florida Republican Ileana Ross-Leighton, a co-sponsor of the bill, says more U.S. military aid will help protect Israel from nearby threats.
Israel's proximity to the Iran, Syria, Hamas, Hezbollah nexus eliminates any room for error in Israel's defense capabilities.
But several peace advocates, including Rebecca Vilkomerson with Jewish Voices for Peace, say the move will only exacerbate tension in the Middle East. And she criticized the U.S. for not using the aid as leverage to push for human rights improvements in occupied Palestine.
For example, just in the last couple of weeks, Israel unilaterally decided to recognize a few illegal outposts that will become now become settlements that are illegal even by Israeli standards. There's no consequences put on those kind of Israeli government actions by the United States, even though it has the ability to say, look, if you're going to, you know, not follow your own policies and not follow U.S. policies, we're certainly not going to give you more aid. And ideally, what I would like to see is the United States saying we're not going to continue to give you military aid if you're continuing to expand settlements.
As the House approved the Israel aid bill Tuesday, it also continued debating major cuts to the domestic budget. Lawmakers considered proposals this week to eliminate millions from the Salmon Recovery Program and the Census Bureau, among other government spending. But the only bill to pass slashed funds for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's climate website, which will save just $500,000. Later this week, the House will vote on a bill to avoid impending cuts to the Defense Department, triggered by the supercommittee's failure to agree on a budget. The Republican-backed bill proposes to pay for the rescued Pentagon dollars with deep cuts to social programs, including food stamps and Medicaid. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Today, protesters gathered in cities across the U.S. to mark the Bank of America shareholder meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina. Protesters are challenging the company for what they call unfair mortgage practices, investment in the coal industry, and rising executive pay. In Charlotte, a crowd of 500 to 700 marched outside the meeting, and the mostly peaceful rally led to at least four arrests. According to Reuters, shareholders approved a compensation package for Bank of America Chief Executive Brian Moynihan of more than $8 million for 2011, up about three times his compensation the previous year of about $2 million in 2010. For more, we're joined by Randy Jackson, National Coordinator for Unity, a coalition of grassroots groups from around the country and one of the organizers of today's actions. He joins us from Charlotte. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on the line and having me on the show.
First, describe this scene today outside the Bank of America shareholders meeting in Charlotte.
Well, the scene today, this morning, was one of boisterous activity from the voices of people's movements from around the country as representatives from various walks of life and various people's organizations peacefully took to the streets of Charlotte to lift up the voices of those people most impacted by corporate greed and the ecological and environmental catastrophe that we're currently living in and the worst economic crisis that this country has lived in since the Great Depression.
As you know, several issues that were important and brought to the forefront today. I want to talk about those in a moment, but first, talk about what happened today. Charlotte, the city of Charlotte, passed measures recently to control protests ahead of the upcoming Democratic National Convention. They include limiting where protesters can gather, allowing searches for certain banned items. What was the police response like today?
Well, the police response was actually rather quiet given the buildup in the extraordinary event that was named as part of the buildup to the DNC here in Charlotte. Protesters and demonstrators in planning the event weren't quite sure what to expect, whether we were going to be facing heavy retaliation or not from the police. The police actually were rather subdued. There were a number of arrests that were taken, but for the most part, 500 to 700 people were actually able to take to the streets of Charlotte and peacefully demonstrate and bring their voices and lift up the messages of those communities most impacted by the negative practices of Bank of America.
And what were those issues that were being raised by people outside the shareholders meeting?
Well, one of the foremost issues that was being raised were by impacted residents and homeowners. Bank of America is the foremost profiteer of foreclosing on people's homes. As you may probably know, there's 11 million people who are facing foreclosure or have been foreclosed on in the past year. And many of those residents and homeowners came today to speak out against Brian Moynihan and Bank of America and its foreclosure practices and its failed loans, the loans that have put millions of poor and working class families and their homes underwater.
What about the environmental issues you were referring to? According to Rainforest Action Network, Bank of America is the nation's leading investor in coal. Coal, of course, a leading polluter of greenhouse gas emissions and mountaintop, contributing to mountaintop removal mining practices. What are the demands as far as coal investment?
The foremost demand was to stop investing in dirty coal and to end the practices of mountaintop removal.
And were people able to gain access into the shareholders meeting? Were there proxies that were able to get inside?
There were about a number of 100 people with proxies, largely represented by National People's Action, who were able to gain entry. They held the floor and they tried to take the mic. Brian Moynihan at one point closed the mics to them. One of our members from a member organization from Right to the City, an owner of a shareholder, was arrested in his attempt to gain access to the shareholders' meeting.
And that person did have a proxy. I mean, was a proxy.
Did have a proxy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a shareholder. Yes.
That's Randy Jackson, National Coordinator for Unity, speaking to us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Unity is made up of organizations from across the U.S., including Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, Jobs with Justice, the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the Pushback Network, and the Right to the City Alliance. The Oakland City Council is scheduled to review a plan tomorrow detailing how city police will address a backlog of complaints stemming from police abuse during Occupy events last year. A federal judge ordered the police department to submit the plan on Monday. This comes on the heels of a quarterly monitoring report that found officers using, quote, an overwhelming military-type response to Occupy Oakland demonstrators. But the department's problems go back more than a decade, when a group of officers beat, robbed, and framed hundreds of people in the flatlands of West Oakland. Despite a legal agreement that aimed to bring accountability to the police force, continuing problems could mean a takeover by the federal government. FSRN's Joaquin Palomino has the story.
In 2000, four Oakland police officers known as the Riders were indicted in one of California's biggest police scandals. Jim Channon represented more than 100 plaintiffs who sued the city of Oakland.
They would be stopped, and then like a magician, a rock of cocaine would appear, and they'd be hauled off to jail.
In total, plaintiffs served 40 years for crimes they didn't commit. Meanwhile, the Riders were praised for slashing crime in one of California's roughest cities. Because of that, observers say the police department turned a blind eye to some clear warning signs.
Among the four of them, prior to the Riders case, they had amassed almost $500,000 in lawsuits against the city of Oakland.
Rashida Granach, director of the community group Pueblo.
So the point of which is that they were known to be bad apples.
But until the scandal broke, none of the officers were punished. In 2000, a rookie to the force blew the whistle, saying he saw the Riders terrorize suspects during his training. 119 people came forward with similar claims of abuse, resulting in an $11 million payout in addition to a legal agreement that continues to affect the department today. The decree lays out more than 50 reforms meant to prevent anything like the Riders from happening again.
Well, the negotiated settlement agreement has laid a series of processes on the department that have set a series of checks and balances in place.
Barry Donnellan is the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association.
Specifically in internal affairs, in order to ensure that allegations are fully investigated.
Under the agreement, any complaint or use of force must be investigated. Court-appointed monitors and a federal judge regularly check up on the department's progress. But 9 years later, the Oakland Police Department remains a hotbed for misconduct, says Grenage, including a surge of grievances in 2010.
We actually had three times the number of complaints filed against police officers than San Francisco did, even though San Francisco's police force is three times larger than our force.
One officer that's recently made headlines is Hector Jimenez. In 2008, he shot and killed an unarmed Jody Woodfox in the back as he fled arrest.
How I feel towards the Oakland police officers, anger towards Officer Jimenez.
Woodfox's sister, Kenita Vaughn.
Just anger, like...
Vaughn isn't only angry about the slaying of her brother. 6 months earlier, Officer Jimenez shot and killed an unarmed Andrew Maupin Buckskin as he fled a traffic stop.
In that situation, he also was covered and, was not properly reprimanded.
Officer Jimenez was fired for killing Woodfox, but last year a labor arbitrator ordered the city rehire him with full back pay, which has Vaughn baffled.
You know, it's almost like to say it's true what they say about the system. You know, it doesn't work for us. It doesn't feel like it works for the low man on the totem pole or African Americans.
In the latest quarterly report, federal monitors found the department remains in only partial compliance in seven areas of reform, including use of force reporting and investigations. Federal monitors are also looking closely at how the department has responded to Occupy Oakland, stating that while they were satisfied with police performance in some instances, in others they were thoroughly dismayed by what they observed.
I had projectiles shot at me. They threw two flash bombs between my legs, and a tear gas canister just missed my head.
You're hearing complaints made by Occupy Oakland protesters at an open mic discussion this past February.
I turn around, and here's this peacekeeper with her baton like this. I turn around, and bam, she hits me in the middle of my back.
More than 1,000 complaints like this have been filed by protesters. The monitors are concerned with how long it's taking the department to answer them all. If they don't start tackling the backlog of grievances by next week, they could face sanctions. In January, Judge Thelton Henderson took the first step towards a federal takeover. After expressing frustration at the slow pace of reform, he ordered that all major police decisions run through a monitor. Despite the threat, though, many officers remain hopeful.
I think that we will be able to actually get this in compliance this year.
Deputy Captain Sean Wendt says the department is making progress on reforms.
You know, most of them are in compliance, but even the ones that aren't, we're 80% where we need to be at 85%. The problem is, we've made great strides, but it's making that last little bit that's really the hard part.
While the Oakland Police Department might be one push away from full compliance, if they don't make it, they could see a federal takeover as soon as July. Joaquin Palomino, FSRN, Oakland.
Each spring, people of the Sikh faith commemorate the new year with the Baisakhi festival, which dates back to the 17th century. During 3 days of the festival, Sikhs from all over the world visit the birthplace of the founder of the religion, Guru Nanak, where he stayed in Punjab, Pakistan. The holy site, called the Gurdwara Panja Sahib, is about 40 miles from Islamabad. Although religious ceremonies are often targeted by extremists, the Pakistani government provided strong protections for the Sikh community, and this year's events passed peacefully. Janine Etter reads for our reporter Gabe Matthews, who joined the devotees in Panja Sahib in northern Punjab.
...28-year-old Taranjit Kaur is one of the thousands of Indian pilgrims who traveled to Pakistan to participate in the Baisakhi. This time, the festival is very special for her.
I am happy to come here as my three sons have a genetic blood disorder, thalassemia. The other two died because of it. I wished to come here with my son, and here we are. I will take a bath in the holy water here. No one who visits this shrine goes away empty.
Around 25,000 pilgrims come to the Gurdwara Panja Sahib Shrine, including an estimated 3,000 from India. Devotees swim in pools surrounding the shrine. Water gushes out from a stone and symbolically washes away their sin. Sikhs believe that the stone has the handprint of Guru Nanak, the founder of Sikhism. During the festival, the pilgrims stay for free at the compound, where they also get their meals. Due to security reasons, they don't leave the premises.
Babaji,
sasrikaal. Vaheguru ji ka khalsa, vaheguru ji ki fateh.
63-year-old Kalyan Singh Afridi is originally from the tribal areas of Pakistan, but he left last year due to the violence and now works at the shrine. He happily welcomes pilgrims into his home.
Guru Navani wal pakriye bandi.
I live in a rented house and accommodate 50 to 60 people from Pakistan's tribal areas during the festival. We also receive guests from the UK, Singapore, Malaysia, America, and India. We are happy when our guests are treated with respect as they have come from foreign countries.
Security for the festival has been tighter than the previous years. The government cordoned off more than a mile of the surrounding area and deployed hundreds of extra police. This gesture by the Pakistani government may warm relations with India, which have been tense since the 2008 terrorist attacks in Mumbai. The pilgrims were also paid a visit by Pakistan's president. The two countries have expanded trade to boost bilateral relations with each other. Pakistanis now can invest money in India and import vegetables and other goods. Sun Singh is a member of the Gurdwara Paraban Committee, which is responsible for security and maintenance of the holy shrine.
We try to send a good message of love, peace, and happiness to our guests from India and other countries. We would like them to see the good image of our country and to take a message of love and peace to the world. The security here is the best, and we are thankful to the authorities.
Despite some signs that the relations between India and Pakistan are improving, many people here avoid talking to media and want to keep their identity secret. But 16-year-old Aryan Kaur says she's satisfied with the security. This is her second trip to Pakistan.
The place where we're staying is good, and we all have good rooms. Last time, the food was not enough for us, but this time it is good, and we all have sufficient food. We have access to all the facilities we need here. We are respected in Pakistan, so I would say thank you, Pakistan, for all of this.
Thank you.
Sikhs visit the shrine twice a year. The second occasion is in honor of Guru Nanak's birthday in November. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Punjab, I'm Janine Etter.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.